Time Edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Hi, and welcome to the Dark Web Vlogs, where I'm sharing the experiences I've had working with clients on some of the most outrageous deals being run over the dark web. The job I'll be talking about today has a history that starts in 1947 and lives on in our present day. It's exciting to some, terrifying to others. But when I was invited by the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, to work on a top-secret research project having to do with life from another planet, I chose excited. UFOs and extraterrestrials have been investigated for years by the U.S. government and the U.S. military, and so the research on alien life forms today is nothing new. But calling on me to help with a very complicated and smart tracking system for their research was definitely new to me. The project would require work in direct contact with the man himself, the survivor, the one alien that walked away from the crash that drove conspiracy theories ever since the day it happened. Well, I would get to meet him, and I would also get to find out, finally, what really happened. And I'm here to tell you, it was not some high-altitude balloon. They call me the Ghost. I'm ex-CIA, and now a dark operative on the dark web. I've worked a lot of jobs, and today is my account of what really happened with that crash in 1947 and beyond. Take a listen and enjoy. It was a Monday, and I literally had received six different requests when another one popped in. I didn't open that one right away because I was looking over all the other ones, still deciding what to do. But then I finally get to it, number seven. And I actually call this job lucky number seven. All the other requests went out the window once I opened this because this one was the one. The request stated that they knew me from the CIA and that they had familiarized themselves with the projects I was a part of, and in particular, one that I had done as a sorter, sorting out information that the United States received from another country. When the USA took possession of it, it was all just lumped together, and they needed someone to make sense of it all and organize it all, sort it into categories, you know, what type it was, what things you could learn from it, things like that. Anyway, this job, lucky number seven, is the same type of thing. They wanted a system built that didn't involve people that could sort their findings out for them as they were happening. Okay, so normally, off I'd go, right? Well, not this time. Instead, once I agree to meet, they just tell me to be ready the next morning, and so I am. And there was a black Escalade waiting for me, with a man standing next to it. Well, I don't just get into cars, but he was on it, and he gave me his ID and let me inspect it, which people that have been in commonly do because you're always skeptical in this business, and you know what to look for, so it kind of kills that skepticism right away. And anyway, he was legitimate. I now knew his name and that he was for real, and I'm going to give him the name of Alex for this story. So Alex knocks on the driver window, and this pretty large guy with a beard gets out. He opens the passenger door in the back, and me and Alex get inside. The bearded guy took my bag and put it in the back, and then we left. We ended up going to a small airport, a bit of a ways north of where I was, and we get into this private jet, and then off we go. And we end up in Nevada. Yep, good old Area 51. Private, in the desert, no one's allowed, right? Well, we all went in, and this place was massive. Of course, they have their hangars and runways above ground, but they also have multiple levels underground. And like so many of my private meetings, that's of course where we go. And when we get to the elevator, there are no floors listed. You know, there's no panel with buttons listing where you want to go. Instead, it's a keypad. And Alex types in a number while covering it up with his hand, of course, so I can't see it. And the doors close, and we start to go down. Now, I can't tell you how far we went or anything because it doesn't show you that, which is really a good idea if you want to keep someone in the dark. I bet some of the people there have no idea how far down they're going to work. I mean, you get a code, how would you ever really know? It actually gives you a really weird feeling. But anyway, we get to wherever it is we are, and there's nothing there but this really long hallway with single lights lining the way, And we go down the hall, and it's also strange because literally there are no doors on either side. It's just one long walkway. And we get to the far end. So we go through there, and then it's a whole different world. When we go through that door, I do notice there are doors to the right and left of us, so whatever's behind those hallway walls is through those doors. But where we are is we're on some sort of walkway, and the walkway goes to the left and the right of us and goes full circle around this huge area that we're now looking down into. There are no stairs in front of us. There are only two staircases at all, one on the center left and the same on the right. So we walk left, and we head down that staircase. And by head down, I mean we're heading down one flight. And I'm looking, and there are at least six levels to this thing. And there are workstations all over the place. Computers, big screens, offices in glass, closed-off rooms. You might go down one level, and the workstation would be on your left. And the next level, it'd be on your right. Now, in the middle of all of this is a cylinder that starts at the first level and then goes down the rest of the way. And it turns out that that is an elevator. And I find out that that is where we are going, because we are going all the way down. The elevator takes us down the six levels that I saw, and then we disappear one level below that. I mean, we are really in there. You can't see up from this level, and the other levels cannot see in. When we get there and get off the elevator, Alex turns to me and gives me a welcome to my new office. So my anticipation is rising at this point. I mean, I cannot wait to see what is going on down here. We walk past a lot of people. Some are at computers, some are talking, some are in lab coats. We go in a little bit deeper, and with a secured card, we go through two more doors and end up in a meeting room. No one's in there, but there's coffee and water, and there's a tablet in front of each chair at the table. So we get some coffees, and Alex invites me to sit down, and when we do, he takes this handheld device of some kind. It kind of looked like a walkie-talkie, but that's not it. Anyway, he gets that thing on and tells whoever's on the other side that we are here. While we wait, he tells me a little bit about where we are. He says that they call that area the silo and that we're in the basement of that. He tells me that he wants to prepare me and that this area we are in is where a lot of the top secret and most progressive projects are done at Area 51. He says I need to be ready and open, because what I'm about to see and hear could be overwhelming to some. But I assure him that I'm okay, and I'm ready for anything. Alex tells me that the work I will be involved in is an exchange of sorts, exchange of information. My job here would be, again, to help them automatically sort the information that's brought in, identify the source, and keep it all secured in digital format. The project that they are working on has grown to an almost unmanageable size, and although they have all the best equipment and technologies to do the work, they want something specifically built for them for what they're going to do with the data sort. So I get it. And this is one of my specialties, and so just when I'm about to ask him a few questions, a light comes on by the door, meaning that someone has just used their card and they're coming in. A woman walks in and smiles and takes a seat. And right behind her, there's a man, and then he walks in. Immediately, I'm thrown back because I can tell it's him. But he is not what you'd expect. This is, you know, not a 4-foot gray character with giant eyes. No, he's actually taller. And he looked like a man, but not. He had very thick hair. It was parted in the middle and kind of hung down over his ears. It was down to his neck. And the color of his hair was really unique. It was a mix of different things. It had some black with streaks of different colors throughout it, like gray, some blue-ish kind of color, some blonde. It sounds weird, but if you saw it, I mean, it was pretty cool, actually. Might be a little difficult for the average hairdresser to put together, but this was all natural for this guy. And then there were the eyes. You know, the eyes are always something big for Hollywood and conspiracy theorists to play with. But I can tell you, nothing that's presented to you in the norm is what this guy's eyes look like. He actually had really dark eyelashes and eyebrows. You know, you'd almost expect his eyes to be brown with the look that that had. But they were more like ice. They weren't blue or gray. They were more of like a turquoise. You know, like when you see a really cool ad for a natural pool in Italy or something, they were like that. And they shined. I swear if this guy put his finger in a socket, both his hair and eyes would just light up. His hands, too. They were the same but different. His thumb, if that's what they would call it, was longer than any normal person here. It was almost as long as his other fingers, and his nails were black. They were really distracting for me at first, but I learned that that's just what they were like. That's how their nails were, naturally, where he was from. So, was he a GQ model by any means? No. But was he a little gray alien? Absolutely not. Oh, and his nose was a little different, too. It was longer, a little closer to his face, and a little bit lower. I mean, if you really looked at the guy, he might stand out to you. But if you were walking down a street in New York, you might only notice his long legs, but you really wouldn't think much about it. After our initial meet, we all sat around the table with our alien friend, who I'll name Phoenix for this story. All our tablets lit up at the same time, and I get an information dump that was amazing. With every piece of information given to me, it only got more interesting. Okay, so the big question on your mind, expectedly, is probably what's up with this alien and, of course, you know, the disbelief that he was even there. They told us it was an alien, then they told us it was a balloon, and aliens are short and gray, right? Well, here's the deal. First off, these aliens do exist, and I mean, to not think there are other life forms out there is really unrealistic since we aren't really sure what all is out there in the first place. They've been around a lot longer than us, and they have perfected many things. Their lifespan is around 4 times our lifespan. So with Phoenix, for example, when his vessel crashed, here he was 55 years old, educated and adult, but not 55 like it would be for us. Either way, now he was in his hundreds when I meet him, and still very young for his kind. He was traveling, at that time of the crash, with 3, not 2 like you may have heard in the stories, other crew members. 2 of them did not make it, and that fact was true, but 2 did make it. 2 of them were alive and brought to Area 51, and so was what was left of the vessel. And the vessel was actually pretty intact, but when they crashed, it killed the power, and without a link to the management of repairs back home, they couldn't get it to go again. Should they have, their side would have scanned the vessel, found the issues, and fixed it from there. Pretty amazing. And here on Earth, we just simply didn't have the ability to start it because we didn't have the materials to work on it, even if we had the knowledge of how to work on it. What they were able to fix, however, with the help of Phoenix, was the communication line. Only to talk, no mechanical or technological lines could be opened. But when those communication lines were open, which took about 6 years, if you can believe that, that's when the partnership began, the partnership between Earth and their planet. And I'm going to refer to that as Z Planet. Before all communications went out in the vessel, Phoenix was able to send one last message. He let his contacts know that 2 were out and 2 were in. Phoenix was the one in better shape of the 2 that survived, and the other one in the end didn't make it. They tried to work on and help him for 6 months. While Phoenix was coming back to recovery, though, the other one faded. Without the medical help that he really needed, this alien's veins, if you want to call them that, started to dissolve little by little. It started at his feet and then progressed up his body until there was nothing left. It was a painful process, but our little invention of morphine did seem to help. The health of the 2 aliens remained the focus until all of that was over. And when it was over, Phoenix told our crew here that they had visited many times before, but were more in the information gathering phase. But then this mission was supposed to be the mission for them to make contact with the right people. They had their eye on things and originally wanted to come down over the Pentagon. But a route failure and equipment failure caused the crash in New Mexico. And so started the secrets and lies. Wouldn't have been so easy for them to pull all that off if they had hit their original target. Of course, the story tells us that a rancher is who discovered this crash. However, our people had been tracking UFO activity for a while at that point, and they were on the scene within minutes. Everything was removed and cleaned out. Now, because Phoenix was able to get that last message out, there would be no one coming to try to finish the job. They wouldn't be sending a backup team. Phoenix knew what to do on his mission and was to really find out what we were up to, basically. When the lines of communication were open, it took them approximately another 4 years to work out all the glitches. And when that was done, the mission was finally reset to have a new focus so both sides could move forward. So the first mission was to make contact and confirm we were worthy, basically, and then establish a good relationship and somehow figure out how to expand both our worlds with both planets. However, after he was able to tell them all about the crash and about what was going on here, the mission changed. Now Phoenix would stay here, simply to learn things from us and teach us things as well. You know, in all the alien stories, we hear how advanced they are and how behind we are. But this isn't all the way true. Just because they excelled in certain areas doesn't mean that they excelled in all areas. They were also particularly interested in the fact that while they have enemies in other parts of the galaxy, they don't have any on their own planet. It was a big interest to them why we here on Earth fight so much with each other. It became clear to them, with that being the situation, they couldn't count on us to be partners, the partners they were hoping for. They knew we had different areas with people living in different ways, and that's part of what they wanted to learn about. I mean, if we were all together, why would we let some live one way and others live another? So basically, that messed up their whole plan, but they could still make it worth it. And as we would learn, they've implanted aliens on other planets as well for the same reason, to learn. I mean, if you think about it, it's actually no different than us trying to learn from different countries. Anyway, some planets would be salvageable in their eyes, and others would not. To establish allies, though, they would need to learn which ones were fixable. And so there it was. We became an exploratory planet. With communication lines open, Phoenix would send back helpful information, and we could learn from them as well. I sort of picture Phoenix being here like we might send astronauts into space, you know? He is on a mission to learn what he can. Oh, and something else I remembered talking about that, time. So him being here for X amount of years is less in his time. He will still age, though, but when he gets back, 10 years, for example, won't be 10 there. But okay, back to the exchange of knowledge. One example is they were extremely interested in our work with fire. Yes, fire. They do everything through technology, so our raw use of anything fascinated them. They use things for necessity. But here on Earth, a necessity can also at times be used for something that just gives us pleasure or comfort. They wanted to learn about that. Our way of learning was also a big interest to them, because they rely heavily on information downloads, and we learn more in a physical way. So Phoenix wanted to do research on the advantages and disadvantages of doing it both ways. Do you just need the knowledge, or what does the experience of learning do for someone? And here on Earth, fairly recently, you might remember the Brain Initiative started during Obama. The secret behind all of that came from input provided by Phoenix. Another one that interested them was, and it kind of surprised me, like they all did, was our vaccinations. They also have vaccinations of sorts. However, they never would have thought they needed some of the ones that we have. So, you know, while they're doing their own research and getting stuck on different things, like what happens to us, we conquered some of those things and could actually explain it to them. And it worked both ways. I mean, there are a ton of examples, and it goes all the way back to the mid-50s. Of course, it took them a while to figure out where to even begin, but once both sides really figured each other out, things really got moving. And you know, this all sounds positive and awesome and hey, why not, and this is great for us, but not so. While we're secretly making all this progress that the government is happy about, and I'm talking about the U.S. government here, the government also got paranoid and livid. There were too many people that knew, and people were being silenced. And believe in aliens or not, I think we can all agree that the government likes to have their secrets. But that wasn't true for everyone in government. And one person we can all go back and forth about is President Kennedy, the president assassinated before the world. This president wanted to know more. He was very interested in all of this and really wanted to be more involved. He wanted to explore and know what was going on. President Kennedy met Phoenix, and he thought it was great. He wanted to actually try to open the door for Phoenix and us and try to bring our worlds closer together and try to support the original mission. But then comes my agency, the CIA. Back then, they wanted nothing to do with that idea. I mean, Kennedy was ready to let the cat out of the bag about what happened with Phoenix and his crew and what was going on with the other visitors we've had since that crash. But the CIA said no. Look up Majestic 12 for yourself. If Kennedy didn't stop, the hit was on. And so it went. Now, I've heard as many or more ideas out there and conspiracies about Kennedy and his assassination than probably you have. But this one, I heard right from the source. And knowing about the documents they tried to burn, I had zero reason to doubt it. And then, aside from all that history and things they've been doing, I got to see some really interesting things, too. Phoenix had a log of when his, and I'm just calling him people because it makes sense, but he had a log of every time his people came to observe the planet. I mean, Phoenix was doing his job on the surface, but they still wanted to study things about us that he would not be doing. And this was all part of the partnership. I mean, they had the okay. They had the permission and rights to hover, abduct, and experiment. In return, we just needed to know when they were coming, what they did, and when they left. So, all the abduction stories out there, well, the government knows which ones are real and which ones aren't. All the videos of sightings on YouTube right now, yeah, well, they know which ones people really saw and which ones are fabricated. And for the real ones, you can bet they have their eye on the people who saw them. I also got to see how alien technology was incorporated into our world, like our fighter jets, how you can see them hovering over you at air shows. Well, all that technology was brought to us and worked into our mechanics by Phoenix. And it's not like he could just tell us how to do certain things, because all of our stuff is different than his. So it took a ton of hits and misses to perfect what he knew and get it to work with our systems. The result? Well, we have a lot of things that we're now using, really advanced technology, but it's being supported by what Phoenix sees as archaic. And the guy, you know, he can't help us fix everything in our planet and bring it all up to the best advancements. What he does mostly is help our military. He's a big military secret. Also, to mess with our way of life goes against the mission. Just like what we do, you know, we study but don't disrupt. It's the same for him. Helping with advancements? Well, according to Phoenix, we've done a great job so far, and we've helped them as well. The ultimate goal, of course, still remains. To work together. And I wondered, at that time, if we would ever get there. Anyway, there was so much going on with Phoenix and the work there, I could have just sat and sucked it up like a sponge, but I did still have my job. My job was to help them, and at that point I could see why. Build a program, a system, that will record what they're doing and learning, in real time, without needing people to do it. Because we've come so far with Phoenix, some of the stuff he was sharing later would have to be things we would work towards because our own technology just simply couldn't support it. Our people wanted to keep their new intelligence more secure, and that meant less people. Only a few would have access to see what was going on. And it was a ton of information, and it really did need to be organized. And so that's what I did. I've told you before how I'm usually in and out of jobs fairly quickly, but this one took a long time, 6 months to be exact, and I worked fast. Each person working on anything in the silo now had a code for their identity and a project code to go along with whatever they were doing. Quite a few codes, actually, so that with all that work, big or small, it could be narrowed down to the smallest detail. And it was a success in the end. I enjoy that kind of work from time to time because even though it's different than the high-action jobs with my team, it's still great work and it'll forever make a difference for however long Phoenix would be there. Which brings me to the end. Before I left the facility, Alex let me know I had 1 hour to spend with Phoenix alone. They were giving that to me because of the nature of what I do. Alex felt I could benefit from a good Q&A with the man. Like this job, there was no way I was going to turn that down, and so I went. Phoenix gave me some great perspective on different things, and he gave me some alternative approaches to the work I do and even some of the technology I use for my jobs. I mean, I'm constantly working with my special team of my own to create special gadgets that can help me on my less than conventional jobs. I'm not going to disclose that stuff here because that's for me, but I can tell you he was a great help. And then things got a little personal. You know, I wanted to know more about the dynamic on Z Planet, how they interact with each other and how all of that works. And he shared with me that they do have relationships and things, and that he actually did have someone back home that he cared about. That was somehow comforting to hear, probably because of how we are here. But when I asked how it worked with him being so far away and out of touch, really, he said that was one big difference between us and them. There were no marriages or divorces or things like that. In their world, people were bonded. And once you were bonded, that was for the span of their life. There was never a deviation. He said that when he returns, all will be the same. Life is life there, more logical and concrete. There are no dramas or stresses like we have here. And I found that so simple, yet seemingly impossible coming from Earth, but very interesting. When I left that job, it was a little different for me than other jobs. You kind of wanted to stay in touch, but that's not an option. It's happened on other jobs, but this one felt more like a once in a lifetime. So it was a little strange getting all involved and then leaving. But leaving is exactly what I did. I will never know if Phoenix made it back home, and I likely never will. Maybe they added to the team. We'll never know. But I do know that there are people getting abducted and there are vessels exploring what we do. I actually often wonder when I see a weird flash or something, if someone's checking on me. And that closes up my job, finding out what really happened with that crash in Roswell and just a piece of what's really going on at Area 51. Okay, now just know that this series is not really intended to follow his timeline of experiences to a T, but today's episode does start at the beginning with that crash that we've all been hearing about for years. The one in 1947. After observing our planet for years, these visitors felt they were ready to come down, make contact, and figure out what exactly was going on Earth. The plan? Come down over the Pentagon, a place they pegged to be the target. They wanted to meet the right people and share their intentions, and they wanted to see if Earth could be a partner, an ally. We would learn later that they had many allies and enemies throughout the universe, and had hopes that our very active planet could be an ally. They came down to Earth with the hopes of working together. But instead, they came, and then they crashed. And that crash is still being talked about today. And we have all heard the stories, and we all have our own thoughts about it, right? Well, Phoenix, the lone survivor, the one alien that made it through that crash, has watched these stories as they've unfolded. And although he finds some of it quite entertaining, actually, he feels it's time to bring the truth to the people. In his mind, there are so many stories out there that it's right to finally put the truth out there. He's given our government so much, and in our own defense, we've given him some great information also. Now, in the end with this whole thing, he won that argument of whether he could tell his stories. Now, can he come out and just introduce himself? Well, they're not quite ready for that, and that's why I'm here. But really, it's the same thing I tell you guys with all of my stories. And this sharing of his records and documentation is a great example. There are so many stories out there about this crash, right? Living aliens on Earth and sightings, even today. The world as a whole is pretty confused about the whole thing and has just accepted, that some believe and some don't. And what harm has it really done in the overall big picture to have these different beliefs out there? None. Let the people argue with each other on what's true and what isn't. Put the truth out there, and then you've done your part. That's what Phoenix says. The people will do and believe what they want either way. All right, so anyway, enough about all of that. Let's get to the crash. Today I'm going to talk about what really happened that day. I mean, what really did these visitors go through that day? Have you ever thought about that? We're so busy being in awe or excited about the whole alien and spaceship thing, we never really think about how they felt or what they went through. I'm sure it's not any of your big dreams to be a part of a plane crash, for instance, someday. I'm sure the thought of it is terrifying, actually, because it is. Well, it was no picnic for them either. Now, in episode 1, I shared with you that there was only one alien that made it out of the whole incident, but there were actually two that survived the actual crash. And I told you that the one lone survivor was not a 4-foot gray creature with big eyes, but that instead he was tall and lean, with longer legs and thumbs, and that both his hair and eyes shined and were almost luminescent if caught in certain lighting. Different, but unless you were really looking, could most definitely pass as human. But that doesn't mean that all aboard were that way. There were two different races, if you will, aboard that spacecraft, and only the one, Phoenix, was human-like. The other three were grays, as we like to call them. Two of them were there for the purpose of flight and navigation, while the other gray and Phoenix were there for the meat. And if they would have made it, I wouldn't even be telling you any of this right now because you would already know. But because of how it did happen, the chance to cover it all up was just too great. And let's get to the reality here with that crash. Debris, spaceship, on a ranch, in a pasture. Well, there's some truth to this, and that bit of truth passed as the whole truth in many tales that would follow this incident. I've already told you that it was not a high-altitude balloon that was their big find that day, like the government tried to tell us for so long, but there was a balloon involved. The reporting, however, said that that was what the big deal was, but that's incorrect. This balloon was there, but what nobody wants to admit is that that balloon caused the crash. We were testing that balloon, and it was not a regular scheduled testing. But with the weather being optimal for whatever they were doing, they chose to send that thing up, just as our alien friends were en route. They were making their way over and across the United States through the air and in stealth mode. And then here comes this balloon. It was unexpected, and it ended up in the way of the alien spacecraft. Now, of course, they can handle that. But what they couldn't handle were the pieces of foiled reflectors that broke into pieces while getting sucked up by their craft. The aliens doubled back and they tried to avoid what was going on because right in the moment, they didn't know. What they did know was that the pieces from the inside of their spacecraft were shooting out all over the place. The balloon was long gone at this point, but those pieces that got sucked in, they shattered and like sand, they spread throughout the inside of their spacecraft, in the mechanicals. And before they could recover, these aliens went down, but it wasn't on a ranch. It was in the nearby mountains, the Capitan Mountains. So, you see, the rancher did find pieces of an alien aircraft and a balloon, but the government would just not give up what it really was they discovered that day. So much press, so much talk. But think about it. How did the alien talk even get started in the first place? That's because someone knew. You've heard the stories about how people were paid to be quiet, intimidated, and even threatened. I mean, and just that could be its own show, right? But immediately, the cover-up began. And, you know, you hear the words cover-up and government and aliens, and you get a little excited. Well, a lot of people do. But like I mentioned earlier, what about the living beings inside of that spacecraft? What happened to them? When they crashed, a few things happened. One, their communications were out. Well, dying. Post-crash, it was very clear that two of those aboard didn't make it. And it was the two that were in a cabin above more of the living space that were navigating this flight. But Phoenix and his partner that were set to meet with us, those two did make it. And right before the communications did completely go out, Phoenix was able to get one message out, that they had crashed and that two were out and two were in, meaning clearly that two had made it and two did not. And then silence. Phoenix, the human-like alien, seemed to have a little more movement than his partner. The gray, that's his partner, was sitting in the seat next to him. But as they worked to get themselves out of the crunched cabin they were in, they were thinking and wondering between each other, you know, do we need to get our weapons? Did they need to run? Did anyone see them crash? I mean, maybe they could try to get their communications up and running and get the heck out of there before anyone even knew that they were there. So while they're trying to free themselves and move about the spacecraft, their injuries start to become more clear, and the gray isn't doing so hot. When he gets up, it's clear that some debris sliced through his side, and with the grays, their bodies are a little different, right? Even in the pictures we've seen. You know, you've seen the larger abdomens, the smaller chests, And just a side note, how did they get that right anyway? You know, how did we know to depict them that way? I mean, think about it. Someone knew. Someone leaked it. So, I mean, stay open and stick with me here. Okay, anyway, the reason that their abdomens are so big, because they really are, is because that is where all of their critical organs are, aside from what we'd call the brain, right? And with the purple, thick liquid that was leaking out of him, it appeared that his injury was serious. I mean, it could have ripped through something vital. That's what it was looking like. And these guys are no dummies. They know it doesn't look good. And you also have to know, these guys do have feelings. Not only has this mission gone terribly wrong, they lost key people, and they care about each other. And two of them are dead. The wounded alien, and I'll just call him Mr. Gray, can't really do much and shouldn't. So Phoenix takes the lead. And just picture being in this situation, okay? This is a story when I'm telling it to you, but remember, these are almost as memoirs, mixed in with a documentation of the crazy things that have happened between our worlds. This story today is his experience of how it was to land on Earth and be completely vulnerable. I mean, Phoenix knows they'll probably be found, and he's learned enough to know that really, their craft has probably popped up on some radar somewhere, and all he can really do is try to get ready. I mean, no matter what the greeting is that he gets, he needs to be prepared. He knows he wasn't invited, and since they didn't come in like they wanted to, where they really had things ready to introduce themselves and explain, now they were just stuck, and the feeling of being unwelcomed really starts to set in. But first, he needs to tend to Mr. Gray. They have things on board like anyone would have or should for medical issues, and he does his best to slow the wound. And then he works at pulling out all weapons he can find, and some he gives to Mr. Gray just in case. And then he goes out and he's looking for this bag that has packages inside. And he finds the bag and he opens up and he counts what's inside. And lucky for them, everything's in there that's supposed to be. And what's in there are 50 packages. And every single day, they each need one of these packages to survive here on Earth. So that's 25 days for each of them, which might have been fine on their first mission, their original mission. But now things are different. So now they're looking at it like, well, we have 25 days. But after getting together what he could, he then goes to work on the communications equipment. And he played with that for a long time, but he just didn't have all the tools. And then there's the very complex overall spacecraft network, and that was down. Somehow, the little pieces of those little reflectors were going everywhere. And then them crashing into the side of the mountain, it was just the right combination at the worst time. And now they were off the grid from their own world. Normally, the spacecraft that they're in can be tracked anywhere, and if there are any problems, it can almost be fixed from anywhere. And how that works is, if their people are connected to the network and can analyze the ship from where they are, 9 times out of 10, they can send what they need to, and the ship will actually fix itself. But that's not possible this time. And I mean, Phoenix and Mr. Gray are really just amazed by all of this, because it rarely happens. It shouldn't happen. And originally, they were on a calm, planned-out trip, right? Their biggest concern at that time was getting over the hump at the Pentagon. And now, all of that seems like it would have been a piece of cake compared to the situation there and now. With no real hope of getting anywhere, they decide they'll just wait for the inevitable. And they really don't have a choice, you know, if Phoenix wants to stay with Mr. Gray. But they're a team, and he can't and won't leave him. And these guys don't sleep like we do, either. They don't do, you know, a 16-hour shift in one day and then pass out for 7 hours. But they do take time to reset, as they call it. And resetting is like our breaks to sleep, I guess. But it's more like once a month, if I were to compare it to our world. It would take all day for us, all 24 hours, to do this. They're hooked up to different things, get fluids checked, their vitals checked in the way that they need to, and stuff like that. Anything that is off or needs to be reset is, and they're stabilized. And when they come out, they feel great. Both of them reset before they left, and they won't need to for a while. So they're awake, and they just sit there awake, not having any idea of what's coming for them. Phoenix said that during that time, you know, they reminisced, you know, they thought about their families. Yes, they have families back where they come from. Hollywood's done a good job for us on these scenes, so you can picture what's going on. You know, they're laughing a little bit, upset, nervous, all that stuff. They didn't eat anything, but oddly enough, they did have water. Yeah, they also need water, just like us. We can go days without water. I mean, we might not feel so good, but we can do it. For Phoenix, though, he would start to get very ill if he couldn't have water for, say, 48 hours. For the Gray, it was a little bit longer. He didn't rely on that stuff as much because his body was different. It was more self-sustaining. But in the condition he was in, it definitely helped. So after hours of sitting there, Phoenix starts to notice some light coming in from the cracks in the spacecraft, and he knows it's the start of another human day. He breaks out a couple of those little packages from his bag, and he opens them up and sticks one on each of their neck areas. And after they do their thing, they dispose of them, and he starts looking around. There's new energy, because he knows that, well, you know, when humans get up, someone will notice something. Someone will see some warning pop up or something, and he wants to get out of the spacecraft to see what it's like now that it's daytime. So he gets outside, and he crawls up the metal, well, I'll just call it metal, to get himself up on top so he can get a good look around. And he sees that he's on the side of a mountain and can now see the damage. The pilots, if you will, sit in that cabin above where the passengers would be, and down below is the living space. Well, where they were at the time of the crash, the pilots, it crashed underneath a rock overhang, which smashed it and took out the whole top part of the spacecraft, smashing the pilot's cabin down just below that. Phoenix is crushed. I mean, he can't imagine what his friends were thinking because it all happened so fast. This was a mess, and even if he did have his spacecraft network up and running, it would be a reach to say they could repair the amount of damage done here. He's taking this all in, and then he sees a row of large vehicles heading his way. And off in the distance, he sees something flying towards him. And what that was one of the Command Husky rescue helicopters. He goes back inside to let Mr. Gray know what's going on. He isn't looking so good, but Mr. Gray is still alive. And Phoenix tells him that they are coming, and he's going to go up top and wait for them. Now, Phoenix was not only sent on this mission because of his extensive human research and knowledge as far as galactic travel goes, but it's also because he looks human. And his studies have shown him different ways to act. So he puts himself in human mode, mentally, ditches the weapon he was carrying, and goes back up top to wait. And he stands up and he starts waving his hands like anyone would do, you know, to alert someone flying above them in an emergency situation. And the helicopter gets there first, and they sit above him for a while before they decide that maybe this guy is an actual person and he might need to be rescued. So they send two men down. And Phoenix sets himself off to the side by the rocks, and he waits. The men get down. They do have weapons. Phoenix puts his hands up, and he tells them in very broken English, because our language isn't really something they've mastered yet. It's hard, you know, to study from space, so really, he's hard to understand, but he actually does a pretty good job. Anyway, he tells them that he comes in peace and all that stuff, and basically, this whole discussion goes on for a while before they realize that he's not human and that he's actually trying to tell them something. The process was long, and then many other people came. You know, to them, Phoenix was interesting, and Mr. Gray was amazing. And here's how it all turned out. So, well, we're all running around talking about Roswell, and there were all the questions and attempts at answers, you know, over there, you know, in the news and in the people's real world. The real stuff was happening just a ways off from there where people couldn't see. The military cleared everything out right then and there, piece by piece, and all four aliens were taken to Area 51, and what was left of their spacecraft went with them. Phoenix was also injured, but it appeared to be fairly minor in the grand scheme of things, and it was obvious that he would be the go-between, and he was already prepared to be that anyway. But Mr. Gray needed attention. And Area 51 has everything you could ever imagine, so they had a place for him to go to get well. Even though they had no idea where to even begin with him, they took all of the weapons, the alien weapons, and stored them in one place. And Phoenix talked them into keeping that one bag with them and explained some of that and some of their medical equipment. And Phoenix stayed calm and personable. And since none of the people receiving all of this had any idea what was following these aliens, you know, who was coming for them? You know, what was coming for them? Were there people coming after them? Our people wanted to keep it cordial because they really didn't feel like starting a war right then and there. And this accident was a good buffer as far as them being seen as a threat, but it was bad for the aliens, and Phoenix was worried about his friend. He insisted that he stay in that room where Mr. Gray was being held, and they let him, with guards, of course. He needed attention, and they both needed their daily dose of what was in that bag. The days came and went, and as Phoenix started to mend and that was going well, he did nothing to provoke any fighting or give any indication that he wanted to attack or that there was an attack coming. Our guys did want to meet with him, though, and his trust for us was growing, so he thought it would be a good move to show some faith that he was willing to leave his friend solely in their care. And he and Mr. Gray talked about this and agreed to this. You know, Mr. Gray was still very into the mission, even though he was basically bedridden. He still wanted to learn. He wanted it to continue. And let me just point out and remind all of us that this is all happening at Area 51. And what's going on the outside is that someone was picking up on the fact that there was more than just a weather balloon problem in Roswell. The debris on that ranch was more than what could be explained. And somehow, it was leaked that Mr. Gray existed. Now, again, this vlog really isn't about that part of it. You know, the made-up stories flying around out there. It's about what was really going on. But I did want to touch on this because it was going on at the same time. You know, I want us to remember that. But because of this leak, they tightened up security. And the way people received it all was more of an incentive for the government to keep it all in the category of top secret. So it gave them more of a case to keep it from us. Anyway, back to Phoenix. So he's realizing how disconnected we all are, right? He's looking at how the people are reacting. And where he comes from, it's not like that. You know, sure, leaders do have things that are kept from the regular people for obvious reasons, for security and things like that. But if we had landed there, he says everyone would know. So he's kind of starting to realize some of our differences and take it all in slowly. Anyway, Phoenix goes into these meetings. And of course, you know us, we want to know anything and everything we can about this guy and his little gray friends. They're a little surprised, though, when Phoenix comes back with his own questions and his own requests, one having to do with the two grays that did not survive the crash. And we agree and assure him that after they were extracted from the spacecraft, that they would hold them until we could all meet on what to do. So that's what they're doing at this point. And this is where the official agreement of abductions actually starts. Ultimately, Phoenix requested that the dead aliens be returned to space, to be let go into open space, and that that would be the end of their life journey. In the world Phoenix comes from, they don't bury or even cremate those that pass. They return them to the place that started our idea of the universe in the first place, a true recycling into the natural. A planet is temporary, he said. There would be no reason to hold a body back in a planet, which would eventually come to its own end and go back to space as well. It kind of didn't make any sense to him. And I guess that kind of makes sense to me, you know, really different than how we see things, though. We, as a government, and I mean Area 51, do agree to this, but our stipulation was that we would be able to study the Grays before they would go anywhere. That we would be allowed to take these two aliens and learn what we could to better understand life in other places. And Phoenix thought about this a lot. You know, as the one that survived the crash, he was now by default in charge. You know, their care was in his hands. In the end, in a decision that made him feel a lot of pain, he said, he does give his approval to do this. He didn't feel great about it at first, but, you know, he thought about it. All four of them knew the risks and knew what they could be up against, flying and trying to make contact with Earth. If they all would have survived, they would have actually been in maybe a not-so-bad situation. From what he could tell, everyone was being nice, but he had a lot to learn. And the overall goal was to exchange information. The accident was behind them, and he couldn't change that. His two friends were there, and they would have wanted the exchange of information as much as anyone. So that's how he decides that for the greater good and for the purpose of it all, to let them be studied. And let me just back up for a small second. So when the Grays were brought to Area 51, Phoenix explained to them that they don't decay like humans do, not as fast. They could sit for a while before anything would happen. But it's just kind of funny because our guys, being used to what they know, still put them in a cold room. They were uncomfortable with the idea of them just hanging around. They didn't freeze them, but they just didn't want to leave them laying there either. But anyway, okay, after they get the approval to work on them, one of them is removed, and Phoenix is shown where they would go for study, But once they were there, Phoenix didn't want to be a part of anything like an autopsy or whatever they were doing, although he was happy to, you know, discuss what they found and answer any questions that he could. And at, you know, this moment was a huge moment in our history. And unfortunately, certain people didn't feel that we should share in this big achievement. We were being given actual specimens to study from another world. But then again, how would the people feel if they knew how we got to this point was to offer us up as well? Because that was what was going to happen. In exchange for us taking these aliens that had passed for study, the aliens would also want to study us. And, you know, that wouldn't start right away because Phoenix would need to get all of his communications going so he could let his people know what was going on. But it was in the works. And in the agreement, it's very clear that our people wouldn't have to die. And because of that, there could be more of them. Anyone taken would be returned. And although they might be scared, they were not to be mortally wounded. Once this happened, things really got moving because everyone realized how much both sides had to bring and how different we were, and just to have this chance. And when that starts to finally gain momentum, Phoenix's friend, Mr. Gray, takes a turn for the worst. And this part of everything was really hard for Phoenix. Remember, he's in his hundreds at this point. We, of course, would be dead, but he's still young in his life. He's an adult, but young in his life. He has been friends with Mr. Gray for years. Way before those two races came to reside in the same place, there was a merging of planets, two allies that came together, choosing to blend their worlds. They both had a lot to bring, and they were better off because of it. And where they come from, by the way, they don't waste time with any of this racial or racist stuff. To them, it's worthless and a waste of time. They say that anything that's living out there in the universe is just life, and it comes in all forms. None of that matters to them. And Phoenix has a point. You know, if you think about it, why would you waste your time worrying about what someone looks like or where they came from if you could actually just work together and make something better for everyone? He was pretty surprised by that with us here on Earth. He said it just creates a messy and confusing world where the people don't push to make things the best they can be. And he's seen a lot out there. You know, it took me a while to get used to all of his concepts, but they do start to take hold after you're around him enough. But anyway, Mr. Gray and Phoenix were close. The fact that Mr. Gray was not coming out of this was hard for Phoenix to take. They were doing everything they could, but we just didn't have the abilities to get him through this. I mean, you know, Phoenix had some of his own medical equipment, but it wasn't enough to deal with the bigger problems that Mr. Gray was having. The cut on his side and the smashing into his abdomen did too much damage, and his body was shutting down. And when all this started, Phoenix didn't leave his bedside. Phoenix thought about himself as well. I mean, time will go fast, and soon enough, he would need a reset. But he didn't know how he was going to get one. And this all became part of the discussions with us as well. Without leaving the room Mr. Gray was in, some of our people were put on a special team to try to help Phoenix figure out how to create what he needs here on Earth, as far as the reset goes. And now you can see, this was a good gesture back to Phoenix. And it was great for us. I mean, they were helping Phoenix, and they were learning so much. Phoenix would tell them little things that would help put this reset device together, and they would bring in different materials and different pieces of equipment and things until they could come to an agreement on something that was the closest to what he needed and that he felt would work. It would have been great to have been a fly on the wall with these guys, you know, working with Phoenix. He shared a lot with them. And because he didn't need sleep, there were scientists coming and going 24/7. He had his own special team working with him to try to create what could test his fluids and give him what he needed and keep him alive. Pretty amazing. And I mean, our team was ecstatic. They had the Grays. They had Phoenix, who was not from here, but he looked so much like us. They couldn't believe it. They were studying the two aliens that didn't make it. But helping him with the reset machine gave them a lot of good information on his type as well. There were differences, but there were also similarities. You know, for instance, water, which I mentioned earlier, and the fact that he did eat. His system could adapt to different foods as long as they were helpful to his system. He could only eat something natural. Anything else, because it wouldn't be helpful to his being, would be rejected, and he could get very ill. That was another thing he really doesn't understand about Earth. You know, why would we eat and drink things that are knowingly bad for us? It was hard to give him an answer on that one, and he really didn't understand it. But these first studies on each other as beings would lead to so much more later. But first and foremost was Mr. Gray. And now he had lost all feeling in his feet. His veins, using our language, were dying. And knowing this was happening only meant one thing, that Mr. Gray was dying. And in this phase, there was nothing anyone could do. Even in his world, this would be Mr. Gray's life coming to an end. Back where they came from, during this phase, the one suffering would never be left alone. There's no more work done on them, and things are just left to take their natural course. Phoenix would not leave that room for anything. His reset machine was now permanently set up in another room, a place that we were setting up for him to be more of a living space since he wasn't going anywhere anytime soon. But he would need to reset soon, but he refused to go anywhere until Mr. Gray was done. Phoenix stayed with his friend through the whole thing. They reviewed his life from when they met as younglings. They shared personal stories of times they shared and people they knew. Before long, though, Mr. Gray couldn't feel his legs, hands, or arms. He was in a ton of pain in his midsection. And at this point, you know, we obviously didn't have the pain remedies that they have in their world. Phoenix had some things, but not for something like this. And, you know, we discovered morphine by then, and like I told you in episode one, this is what helped him get through. When the feeling started to go in his chest, the end was near. And one thing that I learned, too, is that during this process, it's just so different than us dying. And I mean, by what I've already told you, you're seeing that. But the bigger thing is that their bodies, the Grays, will shut down everything else before their major organs. Their organs, even if some are wounded beyond anything that can be restored or repaired back to their full purpose, will work together and can temporarily back each other up. The entire body will shut down before the brain and abdomen organs. And until that happens, his head is as clear as if he was okay. It's crazy. He's in a lot of pain, but he can think and talk and know things right up to the point that his organs stop. And when they do, they all shut off at once. The shutting down of the body is the body's way of preparing for imminent death. Like it knows its beat and it's going to fail. You are going to die. And so then it goes through this process using the last of its energy, and then it shuts down. This trip to Earth was a huge deal for Mr. Gray and Phoenix. They worked extremely hard in their world to get to the point where they could be the right guys for the job. They were a team, and they had been in their work and their studies. Phoenix was losing his partner, and he was devastated. While all this is going on, though, those feelings stay back because he was there for Mr. Gray, not his own grief. Mr. Gray made him promise to make this journey worth it, to exchange information and hold on to the ultimate goal of a partnership with Earth. He also made him promise to fix communications and let everyone know that he made it and that he's still here, and then find a way back before it was too late. He was too old to do so. He told Phoenix that this was his destiny, that he was now a lone soldier, that he had faith in him, that he could get the job done. Phoenix sat and talked with Mr. Gray all the way until he faded. Once gone, he called in his special team and said there was to be another agreement. Phoenix made it clear that Mr. Gray was not to be used for any learning purposes, that he needed to be sent to space free and clean of any sort of human invasion like that. And I mean, we are human after all, and the compassion was there, and we agreed. And Mr. Gray did make it out to space, actually, in the first satellite launch, actually, that included the help of the military, who made sure that he was on board, and then he'd break away at the right time. Of course, that didn't happen until 1958, but Phoenix made sure that it did happen. And I'll get into the other two aliens in another episode, but so it went for Mr. Gray. And then it was just Phoenix. He got his reset, and the next project was to replicate what was in those little bags he brought from the spacecraft. The patches. You know, like a nicotine patch or something. But it had a very unique mix of substances and chemicals that are absorbed through their skin. And I kind of saw this as, you know, like a daily vitamin, only way bigger than that. They needed it. Phoenix still had quite a few left, but they needed to get moving on this first. Like I said before, the health issues were the first and pretty much the only focus when this all got started. There would be no working with an alien if there was no alien. So they wanted him alive and well, and he wanted to stay that way too. He wanted to fulfill his promise to his friend, Mr. Gray, and the goals of the mission. The Patch Project started up immediately after Mr. Gray's passing, and this was the beginning of it all. I mean, from that point on, the information and brain power flying around that place went wild. And that's just one story, and a pretty calm one. Phoenix has many more, and I'm going to bring them to you because he really does want you to know. And by you listening, you're helping him get it all out there. All right, you've all heard of Tesla, Nikola Tesla. And I guess before I go anywhere else, if you have not, you absolutely need to read up on who he is. He lived from 1856 to 1943, and he's well known for his production, transmission, and application of electric power. The guy was friends with Mark Twain and worked with Thomas Edison, who ended up to be his rival. He's been labeled in pop culture a mad scientist and is said to have had OCD, a smart sense of humor, an excellent memory, and all of that on very little sleep, by the way. I mean, Tesla was an inventor, and those inventions affect us and our lives even still today. You know, wireless, broadcasting, the Tesla coil, conductors, circuits, light bulbs, power. I mean, we can thank him for the flow of electricity to our homes, power plants, and that coil. The Tesla coil, that's a big one. It's still around in our TVs, radios, other electronics. The guy got somewhere close to, 300 patents during his life. Unfortunately, some of those are not accounted for, and he had other inventions he never did put into patent protection, but he was doing a lot. Okay, and that's a little bit about Tesla. But this is part of the Roswell series, right? A series of stories, of truths, told by Phoenix, the one surviving alien from 1947. So what does Tesla have to do with that? Well, they go together, actually. And that's why it's helpful to know a little bit about Tesla if you don't, to understand the guy I'm talking about here. He was a big deal. Okay, well, it was really raining the day that I went to talk to Phoenix. So, I'm kind of scrambling through all of that. It's just harder to get around. But I do get there. I get inside and down to where he is. And it wasn't that smaller meeting room where I met him on the first day. And instead, he now has his own space set up just outside of the labs. And he was all moved in. He had a space where he could conduct small experiments, another area set up with some communications equipment and things, and a meeting room. And that's where he was waiting for me when I got there. He was ready to give me a story he said that the world should know. Now, there's always these questions, and he knows it, about when, where, and how aliens have ever, and if they've ever, contacted us or tried to visit us. I mean, of course the answer is yes, but people want proof. They always want evidence. And he says it's a test to believe and that it's been enough time now. Enough years have passed. So let's just see how this goes. All right. Well, I walk into this new area of his, and it's looking pretty nice, by the way. Then on into his meeting room, and the lights are kind of low because he had pictures up on his wall, like a slideshow that he was looking at. And he sees me and he calls me over. And the only picture that I see in his little slideshow is a picture of Tesla and another man in a lab. But then he shuts all that down. And he keeps the lights low, but he does have a couple of lamps on his conference table. I can still look around. He has a few things on these very simple block shelves on the walls. You can still see him even though there's not a ton of light. And he has some pieces displayed from his, now broken to bits spaceship. Some mementos from Mr. Gray. I talk about him in episode 2. Things like that. And then he's got, a thing of coffee out because he knows I like that. And he just welcomes me and tells me to settle in. So I take a seat diagonal from where he is at the end of the table. And he smiles at me. And then he lifts up this cane that was hanging off the side of the table. And I didn't even see it at first, but there it is. And he lifts it into the air and he shows it to me and he asks me if I know what it is. Well, it's a cane. He looks at the cane and he looks at me and he says, it's more than a cane, that it was once a gift given to Nikola Tesla in his old age. And then he stands up and he walks and he stands across from me, at the other side of the table, and he asks me again if I know what he's holding. Well, yes, it's a cane. And I repeat what he said, this was Tesla's cane. But he says, no, actually, that Tesla never used a cane, not really. That what he was holding was a prop, but really it was a communications device. A sort of emergency call button. Phoenix tells me that it was one of those things that, you know, never made it over to Belgrade, Serbia, where the Nikola Tesla Museum is. After Tesla died, they had around 80 crates or something that were set to go there, but only 60 actually made it. And you can look it up anywhere. And there's always the ongoing question of, where are the missing files and where are the missing items that belonged to Tesla? What really happened to them? There are still missing items from after his death and a fire earlier. We're talking hundreds of plans, his data, his tools, notes, and photographs. It was only after his death did people consider, you know, what a loss it all was, what we all could have known, how we could have learned and advanced from his knowledge. In the end of Tesla's life, he knew what the deal was. You know, no one wanted to listen to his wise words anymore. Not that they ever really saw him for what he was or appreciated him like he should have been. Phoenix explains that it's the people that were the fools. Tesla was handpicked. He was a chosen one, a man who was more than capable of carrying out the task of moving human beings along, advancing us, and making us a good candidate for a partnership with others, alien nations. But so anyway, this cane, it was kept like so many of his things. Most of it included items, you know, people wanted to understand or maybe try to figure out and study, but there were personal items too, and this cane was one of them. Phoenix then gives me a look that says, you know, watch this. And he starts messing around with this thing. Well, I have to get up and join him on the other side of the table. I mean, I want to see what's up with this thing. Inside the pole, he pulls it open. There are these little buttons. They no longer work because all the activity on that stopped the minute the cane was no longer useful, Phoenix explains. The cane was once a direct line to Tesla's alien contacts. Should Tesla want out, and maybe want another option, if you will, they had some big ideas that would help him. So in the end, Tesla could stay here and pass on like everyone else does one day. Or he could go beyond and have some other choices. Tesla did some very great things, but a lot of his work was almost rejected. And it was almost like a purposeful avoidance when it came to giving him any credit. The aliens saw this as a waste, and they gave him options if he wanted them. And I know you're wondering, so was I, you know, so what was it? What did Tesla do? Did he die in that apartment that day, or what? Well, Phoenix just looked at me, closed up the cane, and didn't say another word about it. Not then, anyway. He just closed it all up and asks me if I'm ready for the true tale about Tesla. Well, I mean, he's definitely pulled me in, and of course I am. So there we are. We get settled back in. I have my coffee, and off he goes. Phoenix starts out by telling me there was most certainly a relationship that Tesla had with the people of his planet, which I just refer to in these vlogs as Planet Z. This connection between us and them goes back a while, and Phoenix learned all about it when he was still home. Tesla was one of their major active projects in a time before Phoenix even existed. Tesla was the kind of guy who wanted it. You know, he had the drive. He wanted what was possible. He wanted to learn, and he caught their eye. And when they felt the time was right, they contacted him. Now, they weren't just going to swoop down to Earth and have at it. I mean, this was the 1800s. There were inventions coming up. You know, we're about to get the car, you know, but then we also have the gunfight at the OK Corral. You get the point. They wouldn't really be able to get done what they wanted to if they just showed up and shocked us. They wanted to get something out of it. I mean, Earth was a good resource for them, and they wanted to help us along so that our path would be the good one, the right one. And a guy like Tesla was the perfect human to help take the human race where it needed to go. And when proposed, he took it. He wanted that opportunity. So, okay, we know that, but then my question was, well, how was it they approached him? Well, okay, you have a young Tesla in his mid-20s. He's moving to the United States. He gets a job with Edison. He works there. You know, then they're no longer getting along, and Tesla moves on. Not quite that simple, but that's what happens. And then Tesla's looking into things like converting direct current into alternating current. You know, he's looking into meters, better lighting, and of course the Tesla coil. And during all of this, the aliens are watching. They've planted themselves down on Earth quietly. They were not to interfere. No one was to notice them. They weren't, you know, to strike up unnecessary conversations or make any real new relationships. They were simply scoping us out. When Tesla got his coil, it was the perfect thing to launch him and the world into the right direction. This was a sign to the aliens that Tesla was ready, and it was then that he was chosen. All they needed to do was get to him and then hope that he was as into it as they were. And those that were on the case went in, and this is how they did it. So Tesla got his paper delivered every morning like everybody else. You know, he wasn't really a social person for the most part. You know, he thought relationships just got in the way of everything, but the paper he could handle, you know, keep up on what's going on in the world. Well, one morning when he opened his door to get his paper, there was a man standing above it, a tall, lean man. Doesn't look evil, doesn't look like the authorities or anyone that Tesla might run into in the, you know, inventor circles he found himself in at times. You know, Tesla opens the door and the man just introduces himself. And I'll just call him Jules. Jules says that Tesla just had this curious look on his face, you know, like, who is this? But for some reason, I'm interested. Jules reaches out and shakes his hand, and then he bends down, picks up the paper, and hands it to Tesla, and asks if he can have a moment of his time. Says he has information that will blow whatever's in that paper out of the water, and only a mind like his could appreciate. Tesla goes for it. Now, Phoenix, you know, wasn't going to share all that they said, even if he knows it all, which he likely does with how involved he is in all of this. I mean, he just can't. You know, they have their way of doing things like all groups, companies, or like anything goes. You can't give out all your secrets, right? But he does share a few things, some good stuff. So Jules and Tesla sit down at Tesla's little kitchen table, you know, in his attempt at a kitchen. And the first thing that we know Jules does is acknowledge what Tesla's done so far. The fact that he dove into his studies in math, physics, and philosophy, that he came to America, worked with Edison, and then Westinghouse, and then he made it through the Battle of the Currents. Look that up if you're not familiar. Those two really went at it. And he went on about how impressed he was with Tesla during the economic crisis. I mean, Tesla was a brain, but he kept going. He took a step down and he worked on the New York sewage system just to get through it all. Jules saw Tesla as unstoppable. He acknowledged everything Tesla had done and how it brought him to the Tesla coil and how all of that is what brought him there today. He told Tesla that in order to take what was before him, he needed to think outside the box, that it was a test to believe and that he would need to go beyond the people around him who only have slowed him down and gotten in the way. And, you know, Jules is talking and Tesla's following, but the way that Jules starts to swing everything and what he's saying, Tesla also starts to pick up on the fact that there's something strange going on. And Jules and all the aliens on this project, they were actually hoping he would pick up on this. They were counting on it. And so, not too slowly but surely, it's now Tesla talking. You know, he's asking questions, you know, where did you say you were from? Or who do you work for? And here's where some of what happened couldn't be shared. You know, the question-answer bit here. That just stayed between them. All Jules said was that they started simple and that he started to give Tesla proof. Proof that he was not of our world. Then he built up until it was, you know, something that Tesla just couldn't deny. Jules talks to him, shows him a few things, but he doesn't stay there all day or anything. And in fact, he makes his points and then he leaves. And I mean, Tesla's excited. He's actually excited. And Jules notes that Tesla wasn't really even the least bit scared or freaked out, if you will. He wasn't even in awe that he was talking or speaking to a being from another world, you know, like some people might get. Nope, Tesla was just excited about the chance to actually get somewhere. He was giddy about the opportunities this might bring him and the world. The aliens were not worried about Tesla, you know, going to anyone or telling anyone what happened. He was not like that. He was too smart to give up this chance. Jules knew he wanted it, but he also knew how, you know, humans are. You know, they change their minds very quickly. They get influenced by fear, relationship, friends, and pressure. You know, it could be anything. And he had to leave Tesla alone for just a bit to think about this because they wanted to be sure. They needed to be sure. Jules did not go back to see Tesla for 2 days. But then that morning he was back, waiting for him just like before when Tesla came out for his paper. They talked for a few hours, and by the end of that meeting, Tesla was all in. He was committed and ready to go. And from that day forward, there was no turning back. The hope here was that the people would accept and use what Tesla would bring to them. I mean, he was already known as a thinker and an inventor. And the hope was that he would be believable. that his ideas could do wonders for our world, for all of us. I mean, if Earth could get it together, we could get to a more advanced place, then Earth and Planet Z could become partner worlds, allies to each other. The beings of Planet Z were looking for this, and we had the perfect planet, but we as a people were a bit behind to really be able to prove if such a partnership could work. Well, Tesla was in, like I said. He was ready to change the future, and he hoped the world would come with him. Okay, so we've talked about Tesla and his time before his contact and then what happened. And then they're ready. They move their meetings. Not that their first meets were really full-on meetings, but they move to Tesla's lab where he's working at the time. And the very first thing that Jules wants Tesla to understand is the future. You know, the not-so-bright future, really. They've been over it, but he wants to show Tesla things in more detail. And so with this, not only does Tesla get to see the future, it's how he gets to see it. That's an experience. This time around, Jules brings some things with him. And one of them is a black bag. It's a soft, padded bag shaped like a box. And he opens it up and pulls out this black piece of equipment. It's all folded up. He's pulling out these arms and he pulls up this silver piece from the middle. And I mean, Phoenix is explaining this to me, you know, but there are four arms. They're set up to point to the middle silver piece. And then Jules pulls out one more thing out of the bag. And it's like a flat screen where he starts to punch things in. Above this device, above the middle, being projected out of this silver piece. They were looking at it, you know, like we might look at a TV. And you can just imagine how cool Tesla thought that was. It was a projection of the future. And the two of them start going through the years. Real things about the future that would go way beyond Tesla, both with and without the things he could create. And they sit and they watch. And Tesla is just amazed. Okay, now Tesla was not the most emotional guy on the block, you know. Even Jules knew this about him. But Jules did document that that day, the whole experience moved him. Tesla, being the man he is, the way he is, couldn't stand the sight of the future things he saw. To him, it was tragic, a future that didn't need to be. What all they saw, I'm not sure, and it didn't matter because it would never be the same now that change was being put upon us with them starting their project. But it was all Tesla needed to see for him to know that he had to move forward with this, that this was a very real situation. Tesla also got to see some of Planet Z, and that made him very emotional too. There was this world, number one, and it was full of futuristic greatness. I mean, a dream come true for a guy like Tesla. And then the other part was how everyone was in all that greatness. You know, things flowed smoothly, and the beings there had a good system and worked together to continue on their path to better their world and the things in it. It all overwhelmed Tesla, but it drew him in at the same time. He could now see the difference between the two worlds, something that was all too clear to the alien race. Because in general, they saw humans as very different from themselves. You know, that humans could be lazy. Their minds changed all the time. They were, in general, less committed to so many things. And they always seemed to be against each other, always in competition, wanting that individual win versus a win for the world. You know, there were always the agendas. Tesla's seen it. You know, like when Edison offered him $50,000 to redesign his DC generators. That's great. But when Tesla later inquired about payment for the work he'd done, Edison told him it was just a joke. Well, it wasn't really all that funny. Tesla was seen as different, however. He was very practical, very focused. He did things with a goal in mind and with purpose. But okay, anyway, after they take their trip down the road to the future, the work really began for Tesla with Jules and group. The aliens would help him get there, but he had to do all the actual work. And I'm sure that you've heard about at least some of what, you know, he did, what they did. You know, Tesla spends like a decade on lighting, works in fluorescence, radio transmitters, radar, laser technology. He wanted to build the thinking machine, mind control, the thought camera. You know, he wanted to capture pictures from our mind, making earthquakes, supersonic airships. He even builds the first modern power station in Niagara Falls with General Electric. The guy was a machine that never quit. He worked on so many great things. This was his life. He's going and he's going and things are moving along great until 1895, when his lab burns down in New York and he loses it all. Unfortunate, right? Well, he and Jules knew what was really going on there. All of this time, you know, people are fairly quiet about what Tesla's been up to. But also in that quiet and past some of the interest that was actually there, there was a resistance. Tesla doesn't let on that he knows, but the fire in New York was a planned attack meant to push him out. They wanted Tesla removed, not acknowledged or recognized. And his files weren't burnt. His photographs didn't become ash. It was all just taken by people that wanted the win. It didn't matter to them how they got it. But Tesla and Jules, they decided to get a little more aggressive. They weren't going to be taken down. And that's when Tesla moves to Colorado. Colorado Springs, to be exact. And this time, Tesla's going for something big. Something the world could appreciate. Something he and Jules cannot imagine the people would want to reject. And something that, hopefully, the powerful few can't get in the way of. He will show them how we could send electricity wirelessly. I mean, to our homes, even to planes. It would be the invention of all time. And he would use Earth to do it. Earth would be the conductor. Great idea. Great plan. But while in Colorado and working on all of that, there were new issues. Things happened that, you know, you're not going to find out there and available to you to read and learn about. Like the one night Tesla was working in his lab and he got his first unexpected visitor. He was there working on some things by himself. I mean, Jules was there too, but he was in a separate room. But anyway, Tesla's there working alone and he's visited. And this lab, you know, it's not like a building, you know, like we have today. It's not all that big. No one would really have a need to go there. Nobody would probably want to go there. But he gets a knock on the door pretty late at night. And Jules, you know, he stands by, but he stays out of view. It's a man in a black suit. And I mean, he doesn't look like a thug, really, but immediately Tesla gets a bad feeling from this guy. And the guy was bad. He basically tells Tesla to stop working, not to come back to New York, and to disappear, basically. The guy really put the pressure on and warns Tesla that he was messing with something that he shouldn't be. Nobody needed wireless electricity, they said. It was not to exist. It was not to work. The guy says that he hopes he made himself clear that Tesla was not to succeed. This was the guy's point, you know, he made it and then he left. Tesla never even said a word. No matter what anyone said or did, because these things continued, you know, how they tried to intimidate him, Tesla would still move forward. It was for the greater good, as he saw it, and he was not going to stop. The people would come to see, he always said. And he and Jules saw this type of thing for what it was, you know. This was fear coming out. The fear that change was coming and that it would work. And why the fear? Well, for one, because it would disrupt current plans. There was the agenda. Certain people needed to be in control and to be the ones to win. They were already picked for this. It wasn't going to be this up-and-coming inventor named Nikola Tesla. And it was just also the basic fear of the unknown, right? I mean, think back to those times. Again, we're talking about the 1800s. You know, none of these inventions seem that far-fetched to any of us here today. But back then, they were still lighting their streets with candles. You know, this stuff could have very well been just terrifying. Life was just fine to them, in a way, and they just didn't want it. Well, people continued to work hard to take Tesla down. Jules was seeing it, can't deny it, and Tesla is feeling it. You know, he's just human. This wears on him. He is being shot down by the very people he's trying to help. And he's thinking, you know, I know how to do this. I have been given the path, so let me go and take you there. But the hits, they just keep coming. And Jules documented how upsetting this all was. You know, they had their man. Tesla was the one. But there was just so much against him. Even back in New York, which he did go, even after being threatened. You know, so back in New York, after the whole Colorado thing, Tesla sets up his tower, the Tower of Power. He would show them all the possibilities. But that, too, ended abruptly. It was to be worldwide wireless, he said, and Earth electricity for all. But it was destroyed and we got the Waldorf Astoria instead. They literally used dynamite and obliterated any idea of some tower providing any wireless anything. It's pretty amazing. And for the most part, I mean, people just accepted that. It was up, and now it's down. Something that shouldn't really be a shock, I guess, to any of us in today's world, really. We see this happen. Suddenly there's a person that's there, and then they're gone. Sometimes we don't even ask about it. People just disappear. We don't have the answers. And things get shut down all the time. We don't seem to know or care the real reason why. We don't even talk about it. But, I mean, let's face it with this one. Of course there would be no Earth-generated electricity for all. I mean, we know better. How would you bill anybody for that? Couldn't be a moneymaker. To deliver electricity without wires to the world? Well, those in charge say absolutely not. This project had to be stopped. And so it was. But Tesla just keeps going. The guy's relentless and focused on his goals, not what people think they want to hear and know. He has seen what the future could have been, and he still wants to help move things along. And there were just so many things that he tried to share that could have been done and that would have put us in a much different place. But he was never really considered. He was intimidating to other people. He came out of nowhere, and there were others that didn't want him stealing their limelight. Time went by, though, and Tesla got older, and Jules saw the obstacles for what they were. Humans were failing the test, and even though they had gotten the best guy ever to help them deliver the message, it just wasn't going to happen. Not yet. And eventually, people did just think and accept that, you know, Tesla's getting old and getting out of the scene, and then they even thought he was going crazy. They never did forget about him, though, and he knew they wouldn't. I mean, he was a brain. He was always thinking, always inventing. And while they continued to reject him, they continued to want anything and everything he had. Now, let's fast forward to 1943 when Tesla passes. And now it's okay for people to say that so much was lost. You know, now they can say what a shame it all was and how they wish that we knew what he knew. Well, just know, the joke's on you and them. Nothing was really lost in that fire or, you know, those trunks that never made it to Tesla's museum. They never really went missing. People had all that stuff. They found his notes, his photos, his items. The tragedy was they just couldn't figure any of it out. You know, you need to have a mind like Tesla with the knowledge he had to understand what he's saying, what he's thinking. He already knows what he's talking about, and those notes are his notes. He could have and would have shared it all. But good luck picking up some of that and just knowing what it all means. Our top guys don't, and we missed the boat. And now we're trying to figure things out that he already had the answers for. Things like, you know, for one, there was something called duplication introduced by Jules, and it was to be shared with the world. It would have been like, but it was slightly different than cloning. It's still a medical advancement. Duplication, you could work for an eye, an arm, a leg, you know, instead of organ donating. It could be duplicated from one person to another, like a kidney, sort of like the replicator in Star Trek, The Next Generation. And today, here we are, still trying to completely figure out cloning for the world. He had the death beam, which actually was considered, but never came to be. I mean, this beam could drop invaders dead in their tracks. He wanted to utilize water power and save our natural resources. He could have taken us so that we could travel at the speed of life because our purpose was to travel to faraway lands. There was time travel. Planet Z can do it, but we never got there. Now we have CERN, for instance, and they're trying to perfect it every single day when we could have had it. The dream machines, you know, like they had an Inception. And again, his dream of worldwide wireless electricity was feasible. You'd never have to pay for it. We know that one died. And he also had the answer to efficient batteries. You know, something you wanted to release along with the whole tower thing. He could see that we would need more power options. I mean, with this knowledge, we could be storing wind and solar power right now. You know, go ahead and solar panel it up. But I mean, what are you really going to do with it all? You can't store that energy you're sucking up. And we're still trying to get there today and figure it out. And, you know, he also had many predictions. Some we know, and some are still kept locked up. You know, those all came from that glimpse into our futures that he got. Things like, you know, the ways to sterilize water. He knew we would need that. And he said that, you know, we'd get to a place where we'd be giving up certain things that were bad for us. We would realize we're poisoning our bodies. Not alcohol, though. Very interesting. But, I mean, think about it. Would a guy like that really spend all day and night in an apartment talking to pigeons? Or was it just a great way for people to think that he's nuts so they would leave him alone? Would a guy like Jules from a planet with a mission really give up and go home and just go away? Would he abandon Tesla and leave him? Well, let's remember the cane. It was really Tesla's choice. In his apartment and labs, Tesla had that cane. Looked normal enough. Who would question it? Nobody. But we know very well that it was not a normal cane. It was not a normal anything. So he could have stayed, or he could have left. In those last days, in New York, I mean, no one saw him enough to really verify anything. I mean, he dies. He's found by a landlord and then cremated. There's no trace, not really. And that could be how it all went down. I mean, what would you have done if you were Tesla? Would you want to go work with Jules? Or would you want to go down like the rest of us? All I know is that Phoenix wanted to share Tesla's last thoughts while still on Earth, that he was someone with more optimism than anyone, that his ability to dream and grow could have taken us places. We would have a partnership with this planet and could be so much better off than we are now. I mean, Tesla saw another glimpse into the future before all of this was said and done. And it was just like it is. We're struggling for so many things that we would not need to be. And I mean, sure, we've definitely been aided by Tesla. There is no doubt. Just the Tesla coil alone. You know, and things in the medical field. He's already changed the world. But so much was lost because we were in the way. A human life is only so long. Jules and his kind, for instance, they lived so much longer. His confusion was why we didn't want these opportunities. You know, our lives are shorter. Don't we want them to be better for that short time? All he really learned is that we are too busy getting ahead of one another than getting ahead overall. And unfortunately, that's how it all ended up. And where did Tesla end up in the end? Well, Phoenix says we're not ready to know that one yet, unfortunately. And, you know, now Phoenix, he's here to try again. Can we as a planet be ready this time? Will we ever be ready? I mean, after hearing and learning about all this, I have to say I honestly don't even know. We seem to take a step forward, but then we're taking about a billion steps backwards, over and over again. Will we just stay that way so that a few can win at the top while the rest of us just stay behind and holding? I guess we'll find out, maybe eventually. But wow, that was the journey of one man, a man selected for his brilliance to bring us the future, to help us along. He never got there, not all the way. He got most of his credit after he was gone. And then even with his notes and information, I'd never be able to understand it all and get us to where he could have taken us. We still have years on so much of that stuff, if it ever even happens. It was kind of weird, you know, seeing that cane on the table when we were all done with our session. You know, it was like proof Jules was here and Tesla's name was engraved on the side. And at one time, it was something that worked. Did he use it? I don't know. Well, I don't know yet. All I know is that the lights in it are off. There's no energy in it now, and there's no Tesla here to use it even if he wanted to. But we have this story shared with us by someone who comes from the planet that pegged him to work with us to move forward. It's kind of overwhelming sitting there, you know, because you just realize there it all was. But we as a people rejected it. It was too much for us. Did it really just scare us that much? Or did certain people just want what he had? I don't know. But I really hope that you could appreciate this story. I did. Tesla is now known for how great he was, his mind. But there was more behind it all. And it explains a lot, actually. I can see why Phoenix picked this one as a share. It's a good one, and something people should know. And we know, right, that we're not going to get it from anyone else, you know, and we deserve to know what happened. We are the future Tesla saw, and who knows what the future beyond us looks like. We don't have the privilege of knowing that. Time will tell, and our future generations will live it. But like I said in the beginning of this vlog, you know, to believe or not can really make a difference. Fear and the refusal to believe these amazing things that Tesla was doing and talking about set us back as a planet years and years and years. And it's brought on new challenges for us today that would not be. Remember, to them back then, there was no way some of the stuff that Tesla was talking about would have even seemed remotely possible to them. But to us now, of course it all is. Makes you rethink things. You know, things you think are just not possible, that are impossible today, maybe they actually are possible. Maybe they are real. Okay. Well, until next time, I really hope you enjoyed this vlog. Like, subscribe, and turn on your notifications so that you know when I post next. And I will talk to you all soon. And okay, that's a wrap. See y'all next time. Thank you.